Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, public comment on Tepper Sports' request for $650 million for stadium remodeling gives City Council a lot to think about. Meanwhile, Council decides on several development projects, including the Panthers' practice facility. Mecklenburg County Commission shoots down a proclamation supporting Pride Month on a technicality and decides on a new management arrangement for Cats. Opposite sides of the Republican-controlled legislature continue to debate teacher and state worker pay while also considering tying medical marijuana legislation to new hemp regulations. And here to talk about those stories and several more is WFAE News political reporter Steve Harrison. Good morning to you. Joe Bruno joins us. He's a reporter for WSOC-TV and host of the Political Beat on Sunday mornings. Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer, and he's giving us another shot. Ben Thompson is back. He's an anchor at WCNC-TV and host of Flashpoint. Also on Sunday mornings, it's the battle of the Sunday morning show hosts this morning. Welcome to you all. Good morning.
Welcome.
Good morning.
Nice to be here.
$650 million is what Tepper Sports has asked the city of Charlotte for to modernize Bank of America Stadium. They've promised that the Panthers and Charlotte FC will stay for about 20 years, 15, 20 years, give or take, in exchange for that investment. But as you might imagine, that ask is somewhat controversial. This week, Charlotte City Council held a public hearing in advance of a vote next week. How many people spoke, Steve, at that hearing? How many were for giving them the money? How many were against?
I think it was about 30 people or so. And, you know, when the city did an online survey about this earlier, put in your comments about the stadium deal, I think the business community was caught a little flat-footed because the results of the survey were overwhelmingly negative. For this public hearing on Monday, they were not. They mobilized, came out with various business leaders and business owners, and overwhelmingly the people who signed up and came to speak were in favor of the $650 million deal.
How do you explain that the people who did this online survey were overwhelmingly negative, while the reverse is true of people who spoke at the meeting Monday? Joe?
There's just, you know, anybody can fill out an online survey. The city also didn't require you to put where you live or really a whole lot of information on that survey. So, you know, anybody in the world could have responded to that. But also, they scheduled the public hearing at 3:00 in the afternoon. Not a whole lot of people can take off of work and, you know, get down there and talk to city council in the middle of the day. So that probably played a factor as well. Yeah.
Mary?
I think it's also worth noting the business community really put in a concerted effort to have a large presence at the public hearing. The Charlotte Regional Business Alliance sent out an email a few days before to their members, really encouraging folks to come out, sign up, and speak in favor of the project. So it wasn't necessarily something there was just sort of this organic groundswell of support. There was a real coordinated effort in the business community to show up in front of City Council.
And among those speakers at that meeting was Joe Bost, who is with the Charlotte Regional Business Alliance, who urged council members to approve the deal.
This public-private investment is a strategic move to modernize and advance one of our foundational public hospitality assets. An upgraded Bank of America Stadium is a vital ingredient in any economic development formula, and the CLT Alliance appreciates the public and private momentum in advancing this investment.
But some questioned whether this would really be an investment. Here's the Charlottean Bobby Lord.
The asset is wholly owned by TSE, and any increase in the value goes straight to TSE. The city does not receive an ownership interest in the building. The city does not receive any portion of ticket revenue from games or concerts. We don't even have public access to the park-like atmosphere we're paying to build outside the stadium.
So Tepper Sports owns the building. The city owns the land. The idea of partial ownership of the stadium or of the team came up. Is that even a remote possibility?
Yeah, Councilmember Dimple Ashmira asked about this at a meeting a couple of weeks ago, whether there are other NFL teams in the country where the city that the team in has any sort of ownership stake, gets any sort of cut of tickets. And the answer she received was basically no, that this is something that the NFL doesn't like, that this is something that is not at all common in other NFL cities. That kind of setup.
And Mary, this may not technically be a traditional investment. Some people have called this an investment. Others have questioned whether it is one. But there are these intangibles that are connected to this kind of input of cash that could really be called an investment to the general welfare, because it brings the kind of publicity that you cannot afford to buy. That is the argument, that when they go to these beauty shots of Charlotte coming in and out of NFL commercial breaks, you can't buy that kind of stuff. And you also can't, without this building and the ownership team that runs it, you wouldn't have NFL sports in that building. You wouldn't have soccer. You wouldn't have a lot of major league concerts either. And you quote Danny Morrison, Mary, in your story in The Observer. He's the executive director of the Charlotte Sports Foundation, as saying, quote, "We'll make it the best outdoor stadium in America, which will have tremendous impact as we compete with other cities." But the $800 million being spent, $650 from the city, $150 from Tepper Sports, will not include a roof over on the stadium and will not include even coverings over the stands for fans. So does that lock us out of certain major events, including the Super Bowl?
Well, it remains to be seen. Every Final Four since 1997 has been held in a domed stadium. All but one have been NFL stadiums. The majority of Super Bowls since 2000 have been held in stadiums with roofs or domes. And the majority of college football national championships in recent years have been held in NFL stadiums with roofs or domes. So that is certainly the trend when it comes to these events. That being said, both Tepper Sports and the city have said that they don't feel a dome or a roof is necessary, that they feel that they can still compete for these major events, especially with these new upgrades coming to the stadium if the funding is approved.
I know Joe wants to get in here, but are they right about that? Because many years ago, when the city was pitched for a future Super Bowl, we were told that we weren't ready for it. We didn't have enough hotel rooms. That may have been corrected. I don't know. But what about this covering over the stadium? Yeah.
That's something that came up at the most recent Economic Development Committee hearing. Vinay Patel, who's a well-respected tourism and hospitality person in the area, said that he thinks, you know, Charlotte is not a city that's going to get into the regular rotation for Super Bowls, not going to be a city that hosts it every few years, but that he does think the city is ready to host it at least once, in part because of the growth in hotel rooms, which was an issue before, as you mentioned, and in part because of these upgrades. But that being said, as I said, you know, if you just look at the numbers, the majority of the stadiums that get these big events have some sort of covering, a dome or a retractable roof, or even something like Hard Rock Stadium in Miami, which has a partial covering over the stands to provide shade and some protection for fans during inclement weather.
Joe?
I don't think it's impossible that, you know, I think it's possible. Maybe that's a better way to say this, that we get a Super Bowl if this is passed. You know, East Rutherford, New Jersey hosted a Super Bowl. They have an outdoor stadium up there for the New York Giants and the New York Jets. So, you know, roof really increases your chances there, but it's not necessarily, the NFL has said it's not necessarily a requirement. I do think if these pass, MLS All-Star Game is a good bet. I also think NFL Draft is a good bet. And you're opening up your stadium for more concerts, bigger names, maybe WrestleMania, things along that nature.
Ben?
Yeah, I think you've got to ask, you anecdotally speak to a lot of fans, and the fans honestly like the stadium. You know, they got upgrades a few years ago already. A lot of fans already like the stadium. And so then I think you have to ask yourself, then what does it get us if it doesn't get us a dome that ensures more of those big opportunities and events? I think of everything I've seen in the last week or so and all the keen political insight and social insight I've seen into this, the best perhaps came from none other than Cam Newton. And that was on his podcast. And he said he loved the designs. He loves the plans. He supports it. But he said the thing that is missing is Mr. Tepper getting buy-in from the community. And until that happens, it's not going to be success. And I think he might be on the spot.
And what will that take? Did he mention that, to get buy-in from the community?
I think it's, and he refers to this, I think it's going to require a certain public relations effort from Tepper Sports, because after a number of series of incidents that we don't have to go over, but including the Rock Hill situation, that it's going to have to be our PR perspective and effort to win over people, generally speaking, but then also specifically when it comes to the stadium plans.
So there's also this feeling by some that this is a shakedown and one that is shrouded in secrecy. I think, Mary, you quote Grace Fendrick, who we heard from last week on this program. She's an organizer of a petition in opposition to this. She told counsel, "Your handling of this has made clear transparency anything but a priority." How is that the case when city council demanded a public hearing a week in advance of next Monday night's vote on this? How is that a lack of transparency?
Yeah, so I spoke to Grace about this, and she's had a few different issues. For one, the idea that the hearing was not scheduled originally. Originally, the only chance that folks were going to have to speak directly to the city council in person was at their regularly scheduled public forum, which happened to fall on the same day as the vote is expected on the Panthers plan. After a few council members said they would like another opportunity, this public hearing on last Monday was added. Ms. Fendrick also had some concerns that the city didn't do a great job publicizing this. They did post about it once on the city Facebook page, and they did send out a release to the media. I actually reached out to the North Carolina Press Association about this question earlier in the week. They told me that they felt that the city did meet the letter of the law when it comes to open meetings requirements. But that being said, there are some in the community that feel, including Ms. Fendrick, that the city could have done a better job publicizing this hearing. A lot of people have also asked to see the full economic impact report that was commissioned by Tepper Sports and that the city has cited in their presentation on this. I asked Tepper Sports for this. They provided me an executive summary. My understanding is that's what other media outlets have received as well. But there are folks in the community who want to see the full study and feel like the city is not being fully transparent about releasing that to the public.
When you say full study, is that the term sheet that you reported on, the terms of this agreement?
Yes. Yeah, so I asked to see the full study. Tepper Sports provided me with an executive summary,
right.
Basically a top sheet, and I have.
Well, evidently, you report that a member of council also asked to see that, and they were invited to discuss it in a private meeting with Tepper Sports, but were told that it would not be made publicly available. They are asking for $650 million tax dollars.
Yes.
Why shouldn't it be available?
Personally, I would love to see the full survey as well. As I mentioned, it was commissioned by Tepper Sports. The city told me that they have full faith in the study, that it was done by a researcher that they have used before, who has done good work for the city, and they trust what he says. I've also spoken with another local economist, Fred Smith, a professor at Davidson College, who told me that these studies are often inflated. They don't take into account the fact that if people aren't paying for tickets to a game or a concert, they'll probably just spend the money in the local economy in other ways. So it's definitely a bit of a sticking point for some in the community, whether that $1.1 billion in annual economic impact is an accurate figure.
Steve.
Yeah. And the other piece is that Mike, you talked about that term sheet, you know, the actual details of the contract. That's the one that Councilmember Dimple Ajmera and some others want to see. That's the one that the city is refusing to email them. They are going to say, if you want to see it, you can. We'll talk about it, but we won't give it to you.
I have 20 seconds here. You're telling me that the city of Charlotte, city management, won't show council the term sheet? Not the Panthers, it's the city.
Yeah, they've shown it to some council members, but not all.
Yikes. Okay, we have to take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk more about this because there's a lot more to talk about when it comes to $650 million. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's the Charlotte Talks Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. We're here with Ben Thompson, anchor at WCNC-TV and host of their Flashpoint program on Sunday morning. Joe Bruno is also here to fight off competition. He is a reporter at WSSC-TV and host of their Political Beat program on Sunday morning. Mary Ramsey is the local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer, and Steve Harrison is our political reporter here at WFAE. Let me go back to this idea that the city will only show the term sheet for this deal between the Panthers and the city and their $650 million ask. They will only show the term sheet to city council members in private session. They won't distribute it. Is that because this is a negotiation and you don't let out your side or the other side's terms until the deal is done? Or is there more to it than that, Steve?
Well, under state law, because the deal, the economic development deal, isn't officially done, they can... You know, it is not a public record yet. I don't know their official reasons. The term sheet is, some council members apparently have it. Others have been told, we'll just tell you about it because it's still a work in progress and we're making changes. There's been some frustration. I mean, the $650 million will pass almost certainly. It's not, yes. This is not whether it will pass or not, but I think there's an issue of whether, you know, how many no votes, if any, there are. No one on council, if you're voting yes on this, you do not want a 6-5 vote. You do not want a narrow vote, because then every one of those six, where they are or were, will be the swing vote. Like, you don't want to be that person. So they are trying to, like, marshal, you know, get enough support. But there is some frustration on council that they want to see more information, and the city is reluctant to give that up at this moment.
It is not necessarily unusual for city council, it seems to me, to hold public hearings and get public input, rather, from people during afternoon sessions as opposed to evening sessions. But when you're spending $650 million, or you're asked to spend that amount of money, doesn't it make more sense to do it in the evening when more people are available, or is it deliberately in the afternoon so you don't get too many no votes?
You know, I don't know. They weren't planning on doing a public hearing. And so they kind of, and they only had that one Monday that they could. And there was this already rezoning night, which already goes until midnight as it is. Okay. So in order to rush one onto the schedule, they were kind of limited to that. I will also note, on Monday, you do have the ability to sign up and speak about the project. It's just, odds are, council members will know how they're voting going into that meeting.
So I mentioned tax dollars. This is not going to increase your taxes, because this money will come from the tourist tax on food and beverages at restaurants and bars, and from hotel taxes, which are collected every single day. It's the only thing this money allegedly can be used for legally, although some jurisdictions are questioning that and taking their shot at using it for other things, much to their chagrin later on, they find out. But clearly businesses believe they would benefit from this, and many of them testified to that fact at Monday's council meeting.
We have seen an amazing growth when it comes to our businesses.
And Allison Somerville of the Charlotte Regional Business Alliance spoke about the excitement businesses had over the potential economic impact of funding Tepper's request.
Making upgrades to the stadium will ensure it continues to be a critical economic development asset for Charlotte.
But landscape architect Sylvia Cobb objected to taxpayer funds being used for these upgrades.
I think this is wrong. I'm here to represent the middle class. Why are you giving someone that has that kind of money $650 million? I think it's criminal.
And she made this comment to WBTV, something others have been wondering about.
Why would you give all that money to a team that's not doing well?
Some on council feel that they're also being rushed into making this decision. This week, the Charlotte Observer editorial board, Mary, agreed with that, pointing out a nagging question. And the question was, why the rush? Let me ask you, why the rush?
Yeah, well, the editorial board operates completely independently from me. I have nothing to do with what they say. I will say, when that question has been posed to city staff by city council members, they were basically told, we are about to take about 6 weeks off after this June 24th meeting for our traditional summer break, and we don't need to be causing holdups when it comes to getting this work going over at the stadium. So we just have to get it done before everybody heads on vacation.
Joe.
I just will also say, I said this, I think, last week, too, though, that There have been four closed sessions on this. There have been four meetings with council members and working groups. The fact that this deal surfaced on June 3rd is not a surprise to council members. The deal is pretty much the same exact thing I reported on a year ago. If they wanted this to happen at a different time, they could have demanded the city manager bring it to the public sooner than the couple weeks before their vacation.
So as one of you just said a moment ago, the outcome of this is a foregone conclusion, one would imagine, unless something surprising happens. But the vote is Monday night. Is that correct? Okay, that is correct.
The agenda's not out yet, but okay. Yes, okay. The plan.
And so on Tuesday, on this program, we will be doing a kind of an aftermath of that vote program, and many of you will be on the program with me that day. Meanwhile, City Council voted this week unanimously to approve a Panthers rezoning petition for the team's new practice facility on 12 acres on the east side of South Cedar Street. There were some community concerns about this. More than 500 people signed a petition calling for the council to reject the facility. They did not. Why were the concerns? What were the concerns over?
Yeah, so this petition was specifically centered around a very popular pedestrian pathway that cuts through the property. Given the way some of the rezoning petition was phrased, people in the community were concerned that they were going to lose access to this really popular path for people to get to the stadium on game days and also just get to and from Uptown during the workday. Both the city and Tepper Sports have said that the pathway is still going to be available. It's actually going to be widened in some places. Some folks in the community had also expressed some concerns about the height of the new indoor facility, things like that. Again, both Tepper Sports and the city said, we met with the community, we had meetings, we worked through their concerns, and all's well that ends well.
So would it be accurate to say that those concerns have been adequately addressed and that the 500 people who signed that petition are happy?
That's the message from City Councilman Malcolm Graham, who covers that district, said, you know, he was out in the community talking to folks, helping facilitate conversations between neighbors and the Panthers, and that everybody came to a happy conclusion.
Council also approved two other major projects on Monday night. They unanimously approved a South Charlotte development project involving 566 housing units. That's down from 1,100 units. Near Railroad and Elm Lane. We have been talking about this for a long time on this program. What sort of housing will this be? Joe?
Primarily apartments, but there will be some townhomes, I believe, that are part of this complex as well. Originally, it was 1,100 units. Through more than a year of negotiations, though, it was basically cut in half, 566 units. But all of the traffic improvements that would have been made with the full amount of units will still be put in place for the reduced amount.
So does that eliminate the fears over traffic congestion that were brought up when it was 1,100 units?
Well, for most of the neighbors, I guess there was a working group with the neighbors who were really opposed to this project, and they took a vote, and an overwhelming majority said they now support this new project.
Meanwhile, in Elizabeth, council voted 9-1 to approve an apartment and retail project that's just under 2 acres of land at 1801 East 7th Street. This is around 7th and Clement, for those people who know that area. This involved rezoning the area into a mixed-use development area. And if you're not familiar with Elizabeth, it is primarily a neighborhood of single-family homes. And 7th Street is becoming quickly changed by rezoning. Does this follow the lines set out by the UDO, the Unified Development Ordinance? I've stumped the mic.
Go ahead, Steve.
Oh, I was going to say, I mean, you know, it needed the rezoning, and you guys jump in if I'm a little off on this one, but it certainly follows the spirit of the UDO in that we want more housing, we want more density. So while it needed a rezoning, it basically meshes with the general idea that the city is putting forward of building more housing as fast as possible.
So that this will bring in 175 multifamily units plus retail and below ground parking in that area, and the building height will max out at 75 feet tall. I don't know how many stories that is, but it's taller than the surrounding homes in that area, substantially so, and that has some area residents in that neighborhood concerned that the building is simply too tall. It will dwarf them. The 7th Street corridor has been undergoing changes that many people are concerned are changing the character of the Elizabeth neighborhood. But District 1 City Councilman Dante Anderson says the building, quote, will fit right in with the Elizabeth neighborhood. How can he say that? This is completely different than the neighborhood.
Well, based on the UDO, apartments can be built on this property. It's just, do you want a 65-foot box that looks like everything that exists in South End right now, or do you want this aesthetically pleasing development that will have retail and add to the community, is the argument that council members and other activists were making that were in support of this. 78 feet is the height from the street, but back toward the single family homes, I believe it goes down to 45. We got a streetcar that runs through the heart of Elizabeth. It is right along this transit line. There's going to be development in Elizabeth. And I think the argument is, let's get something good for the neighborhood that will, you know, add value to it instead of, you know, just a generic apartment complex.
This actually reminds me a little bit of what happened in Northwest Washington, D.C., particularly along the Wisconsin Avenue corridor, where you have these retail spaces and taller buildings, and then right behind them are standard neighborhoods like you would see in Elizabeth. And people have learned, I guess, to live with that. Speaking controversial, Mecklenburg County Commissioner George Dunlap found himself in the center of a controversy, one that he and fellow Commissioner Elaine Powell were involved in when they blocked a Pride Month proclamation from being put on the agenda. You report, Joe, that the meeting was off the rails as it, quote, devolved into personal attacks, pleas, and confusion. Explain.
Yeah, it was very messy. It was a very, I don't know, Mary and I were both there. We were laughing the whole time because this is just like, you know, it's a proclamation and it means a lot to the LGBT activists who were there. It would take 2 minutes to pass. But instead, we had this prolonged debate over whether or not to even put it on the agenda. So Pat Cotham got a message from LGBT leaders asking, hey, where's our Pride proclamation? You guys haven't done it yet. So she said, okay, oh, shoot, it looks like nobody did this. I'll put it forward. So she tried to get it on the agenda last Friday. And that didn't meet the deadline, essentially, for items to be placed on the agenda. It could still be placed on the agenda if chairman says it's fine, or if there's a unanimous vote by the Mecklenburg County Commission. The chairman ended up not saying it's okay because it violated procedure. And so now again, this huge debate over procedure.
Yeah, George Dunlap, as you just said, made a point of saying that this was strictly about procedure.
As has been stated, there is not one person on this dais who does not support the LGBTQ community. This is not about whether we support it or not. It is about following rules.
Is it politically wise to be such a stickler and take more time on debating procedure than it would have taken to pass this proclamation?
It doesn't seem like a politically wise decision to do this because, again, it's not like Pat was putting forward, let's vote on $650 million to match city council on the Bank of America Stadium project. This was just a proclamation, and it seemed like there were a lot of personal attacks and motivations behind all of this. And it was a distraction. It really upset the LGBT activists who were in attendance. And, you know, in this, you know, time that we're all living in when LGBT members of Charlotte and across the nation are just constantly feel like they're under attack, for this to really play out in the way it did was disappointing.
One of the activists that spoke up was a gentleman named Cameron Pruitt.
The president the governor, Guilford, Wake, Buncombe, New Hanover, Durham, all found ways to get a proclamation out in June for Pride Month. Why is it that my county commission couldn't?
And Bethany Corrigan, a member of the Carolina's LGBTQ plus Chamber of Commerce, also told commissioners how upsetting this decision was.
I am so tired of being politicized. Commissioner Jarrell, I agree with you. Your vote today does not validate or invalidate who I am, but it sends a message to your community. And the message will be that Pride Month was not important to you.
Pride Month is June. It's June 21st. Why are they just getting to this?
Well, Ben? I would have said it, they should have dealt with this a long time ago, but I had a slightly humorous, sobering interaction with my husband about this. When he said to me, he's like, what in the world is this about? And it reminded me that sometimes we get caught up in our world of news in Charlotte, and that you have normal people going about their daily life who don't realize these things and don't understand the importance of something like this. You know, these proclamations happen all the time, you know, on a weekly, monthly basis. And it's important to a lot of people out there, whether it's a social cause or a medical cause. But as I said to my husband, and I've said to other people, this is not really an issue about a proclamation of pride. It's about effective governance or a lack thereof. And that's really what it came down to. Pride is not controversial in Charlotte. It's not controversial in Mecklenburg County. It is certainly in other places, no doubt about it. But the last time pride was at all controversial was more than 20 years ago, Pat McCrory. And he did not want to have pride. He said it should be in a hotel, not on the street, said the human rights campaign was not welcome in town. That was the last time pride was a really controversial thing in Charlotte. What happened this week, as an observer of this, seems like to be just a failure of effective governance, not a lack of support for the LGBTQ community.
So I have a minute left. Steve and Mary want to get in on this. Steve, you were first. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it was interesting, you know, that Pat Cotham brought this forward and was pushing for it. I mean, in her career, she's always been a pretty very strong advocate of the LGBT community. But before her election in March, the primary election in which she lost, she was given a really bad rating by the LGBT Mec Dems. This was, you know, part of the fallout, I'm sure, over Tricia Cotham going to the Republican Party. And she was deemed insufficient on their scorecard. But then this is probably one of her last big acts as a commissioner, and she nevertheless pushed for this to be on. She fought for them. I just think that was an interesting, you know, bit of kind of subplot to this.
I'm going to come to you, Mary, but we'll have to do it after the break because you won't be able to sufficiently speak in the time allotted here. But when we come back, there was also a division on council over this, and we'll hear some of their comments as well when we come back. We'll also be talking about the CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings being disappointed in the gubernatorial veto. Why? We'll tell you in a moment. Stay with us. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Steve Harrison, WFAE's political reporter. Joe Bruno's a reporter at WSSC-TV, host of The Political Beat on Sunday mornings. Ben Thompson, anchor at WCNC-TV and host of Flashpoint on Sunday mornings. And Mary Ramsey is with us. She is the local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And this keys right into what you report on, this issue that we're talking about, the lack of action on the part of county commission to pass a Pride Month resolution on a technicality. You wanted to jump in here and say something, Mary.
Yeah, just wanted to underline Ben's point about how routine this is, to the point that there literally was a proclamation ready despite this sort of coming up at the last minute, because they basically just copy and paste the same language every year and change the year. some commissioners, in fact, went ahead and signed the document, even though it wasn't officially voted on, and said they will still give it to members of the LGBTQ community as sort of a ceremonial nod and symbolic gesture, even though it wasn't officially voted on. You know, I'm at these county commission meetings, I'm at city council meetings. These proclamations, they usually do one or two a meeting, always fly through without any sort of conversation on everything from, you know, awareness for foster care, to Alzheimer's research, to Ramadan or Passover. You know, these are very routine things. There's never any sort of debate. The only, you know, conflict I've seen surrounding proclamations before this was when some in the community were pushing for a proclamation related to the conflict in Israel and Palestine. And the response from the city council was basically, we don't do proclamations for controversial things, but they do them for pride because it's such a widely accepted just event in the community. So like you said, a lot of disappointment in that community, a lot of conversation about the fact that, you know, hate crimes against the LGBTQ community are on the rise, anti-LGBTQ legislation is on the rise. So just surprise and disappointment that a board that's all Democrats, all pretty liberal Democrats, I think it's fair to say, couldn't come together and get 11 votes for a simple Pride Month proclamation that they've passed for years.
And the reason for this, going back to the very beginning of this part of the conversation, was that County Commission Chair George Dunlop said this: they didn't follow the rules, and the rules have to be followed. And because of that, he took a lot of heat. And Elaine Powell, as a fellow commissioner, also voted against this proclamation, I think for the same reason. And she defended Commissioner Dunlop.
I feel like the chairman is being villainized, and it really troubles me. He doesn't deserve this. He was following process.
But there were commissioners who backed putting the proclamation on the agenda despite the technicality, including Commissioner Vilma Leek.
And my son suffered in the school system, in this community, because he was gay and died in 1993 of AIDS.
Procedural or not, many in the LGBTQ community took this as an affront, as we've been talking about, among them activist Liz Schaub.
This proclamation may just have been a piece of paper to some, but it's not to us.
And Bethany Corrigan with the Carolina's LGBTQ Plus Chamber of Commerce made that point, that some things should circumvent process, and she had a warning.
My community will not see your rules as superseding our existence.
Commissioner Lee Altman called the content of the proclamation, quote, beautiful, and said we can unanimously put this on the agenda and be in full compliance with the rules. Since the majority of commission was in favor of it, why didn't they? What
because
stopped
it? Because
the
rules say to place something on the agenda, they all have to agree to do it. That is in their rules. They could have done it in this case. They would have been compliant with the rules. So this whole debate over a rule not being followed kind of is a moot point. And going back to Commissioner Powell, she said she voted. She was basically going to vote however George Dunlap voted. She didn't want him to be on an island because she thought he was being treated unfairly throughout this process.
Okay. Mecklenburg County Commission also voted 6-3 on Tuesday to approve a new agreement between the city of Charlotte, the county, and the towns in Mecklenburg about how to run Charlotte Transit. Steve, how does this new arrangement change things?
Well, maybe not that much. The three commissioners who voted no, Pat Cotham, Elaine Powell, and Susan Rodriguez McDowell, I think they felt that the new agreement didn't give enough power over to the towns and the county. You know, this goes back to this debate over the light rail investigation a year ago, and that the city held all the power. This is an attempt at a power share agreement. There's debate as to how much the city really gave up. And so that was the source of the three no votes.
And County Commission Chair George Dunlap sees this as an improvement.
And while there are those of us who would have wanted the eastern leg of this project to move forward, I think we've got the best deal that we could get out of this. And I think at least five of the six towns are happy.
He's referring to the fact that in order to bring the red line to Davidson, they cut the silver line to Matthews. Is this going to become the same kind of burr under their saddle that the lack of rail was to the northern county towns?
Yeah, I think so. I think when we do debate the third transit tax in 2050, let's say 2045, then the debate will be the silver line will be, we were promised this 30 years ago. Where's, you know, just as the red line is today, I think that the silver line will kind of move up next in the priority list. But yeah, this will go on a long time.
The transit plan that we put forward several years ago was heavily criticized by legislative leaders in Raleigh, whose approval is necessary if we want to levy an additional cent sales tax for transit. But Ben, you spoke yesterday with House Speaker Tim Moore, who is running for Congress in a district that includes Charlotte, and he told you that, speaking for himself, he likes the newest plan because of its more regional approach.
We have not caucused this issue. We've not had a broader discussion. As I've met with business leaders and other advocates for this program in the Charlotte area, I like the fact that it's a regional approach. I think that's important. But I do believe there needs to be a true emphasis on roads. That is how 99% of the people get from point A to point B. And we have to keep up with those demands.
The need to focus on roads is something he was adamant about several months ago. And his latest impression of this plan is his latest impression of this plan based on this decision to cut the Silver Line, et cetera, and maybe depend more on cars.
Yep. I asked him specifically about the 40-40-20 plan, as some have referred to it, including 40% for roads, 40% for rail, 20% for bus and other. And his quote was, "I am open to it," which for anybody who's been following this, the rest of the panel who's been speaking to city leaders now for the last 3 or 4 years, you got the sense along the way they were talking in vacuums and not to people up in Raleigh. And from all my covering of this over the last few years, this was the first indication from a leader in Raleigh, not just a leader in Raleigh, but Tim Moore, who is arguably the most, if not one of the most powerful men in the state of North Carolina, saying, hey, this new plan, actually, I like it. I'm open to it. I got to take it back to my transportation chair and a few other people in my caucus. But so far, I like it. That's a big deal.
Yeah, and we've been pondering why there haven't been more discussions. Maybe there have, we just don't know about them, between Charlotte and Raleigh on this. And Tim Moore told you yesterday that more discussion is needed.
In all fairness, we have not yet received the formal written plan. We've talked about it conceptually, but as far as someone laying a plan in front of me and saying, this is exactly how it will go, we've not been presented with that yet.
What if anything did he tell you about allowing a sales tax referendum for transit to be on the ballot within the next 2 years?
He said he would not make a forecast on that ultimately that's going to come down to city leaders and what they're willing to do, and they're going to eventually have to put it on the ballot. But he said that he would have to go back, talk to his caucus in Raleigh and see where they stand. But it seemed to be, to me at least, a more optimistic view. But it does boggle your mind that after talking to city leaders about this for so long, that I then go to the Speaker of the House and that he still doesn't have an actual plan in front of them.
You also spoke to him about, several things for your Flashpoint program on Sunday morning. They released their budget in the House this week with a recommendation to raise the starting salary for teachers from $41,000 to $44,000 a year. And in that conversation with House Speaker Tim Moore, he told you that the House teacher pay proposal is most important to him.
Your plan gives teachers a pay raise. Senators say no. For you, is this a sticking point?
It really is, because we, and I will say that the second year budget we have does automatically provide a 3% pay increase for, you know, for teachers, for state employees. But we want to add that up. We want to plus that up by another 1%. We have the funds to be able to do so. And we are seeing some recruitment issues.
So how does the House budget differ from the Senate's when it comes to teacher raises?
The House budget includes them and the Senate does not. House budget also includes pay raises for state employees as well. The Senate President Phil Berger has indicated that his caucus has no appetite for it, and that they plan to go home at the end of the month. It's also rare to have both the House and Senate in Raleigh release a budget in the same week. It doesn't often happen like that. So something big's going to happen next week in Raleigh, and either they're going to come to get agreement and compromise on this, which at this point I don't see a path, or the budget they passed last year, which still does include a small increase for teachers and other state employees, it will become the de facto budget going into July 1st.
And while we're on the subject of the budget, the state House members have a plan for spending the $1 billion revenue surplus on Medicaid needs and infrastructure projects. And Senate Leader Phil Berger doesn't like that.
We have agreed to dip into the reserves, but not nearly to the tune that the House wants to. And we've only done that to try to get a deal. And they continue to want to spend way too much money.
He also said that negotiations between the two chambers aren't making any progress, and it's possible they could end the session without a budget agreement. Steve, what would happen then?
Then the kind of the budget passed last year would just go into effect for another year. You know, employees and teachers would still get raises, but not, you know, for instance, not the additional raise that the House wants. So yes, it won't be the end of the world, but we would just go back to where we were before.
And finally, there is opposition by Tim Moore in the House to moves being made in the Senate to try to legalize medical marijuana by tying it to legislation in a bill that would regulate hemp and CBD products. The Senate has already passed that bill. The House doesn't want any new regulations for products that are currently on the market that contain THC. Why this battle?
It's interesting to me because Tim Moore is the first to tell you, as often happens on social issues, I'm okay with it. I don't have a problem with medical marijuana. I think it makes sense. But when I take it back to the other members of the House, there's not support there. I asked him specifically if he had taken a recent poll, and he said he had not because he had not sensed a change in his House members. Last one he did was last fall, but it was clear to him that there was not support for it to go through.
Governor Roy Cooper vetoed a partial rollback of North Carolina's Raise the Age law. It would have sent 16 and 17-year-olds accused of serious felonies straight to adult court rather than starting in juvenile court and then transferring to adult court. CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings was not happy with the governor's veto, Joe. Why?
Now, he's disappointed. This is something that he was really hoping for to help out. You know, I think CMPD in general is tired of arresting the same juveniles over and over again for serious violent crimes. And they feel like this would have been a good step forward into, you know, holding people accountable. The three 16 or 17 year olds, three minors last year accounted for 120 crimes, just those three, the top three offenders. And, you know, it's a weekly basis now. We're reporting on some high profile crime involving a juvenile. So from CMPD's perspective, they would have liked to have seen some of these more serious felonies going to adult court automatically. They still can go to adult court now, but it's just a lengthy process and there's a lot more burden of proof to get those cases transferred.
So why did the governor veto it?
The governor said vetoed it because he was afraid this would chip into the state's Raise the Age law, which it would. And that was a significant piece of bipartisan legislation that took a long time to pass. And he is concerned that some of the 16 and 17 year olds or minors, their cases would be better served in juvenile court so they could have access to treatment programs.
So Johnny Jennings may soon be happy, Ben, because you talked to Tim Moore about this. What did he say?
Yeah, he did not mince any words. He said, enough is enough. Next week, both the House and Senate plan to override the governor's veto, which means in a rare case of bipartisanship, you've got, you know, some of the people here in Charlotte and the Republicans rally who are on the same page, even if they're not on the same page as the governor.
Hmm. 4 years have passed since a mass shooting. We just went through Juneteenth again this year, but there was a mass shooting at a Juneteenth celebration on Beatty's Ford Road in West Charlotte 4 years ago. Remind us, Joe, what happened that day.
There was a significant shooting that happened at this Juneteenth festival off Beatty's Ford Road. Four people died. Hundreds of shots were fired. There were a lot of witnesses, but still no arrests.
And Charles Billings, who lost his son, one of four people, I think, who died in that gathering, has been campaigning for some results in this investigation for years now. He said, you got all these cameras and it makes you wonder, do you care? Why has no one come forward? Why haven't they been able to identify the perpetrators of this, given all the cameras that were around in cell phones, etc.?
It's really sad. And you know, hard to believe that of all the witnesses that were there, it was a significantly well-attended event, and nobody has come forward with information that could lead to an arrest at this point. It is something that CMPD is still actively working on, but the father who spoke to us really just wanted to make sure that this story remains alive so they can find justice.
And I have 45 seconds, and you wanted to talk about this new store coming to South Park, or maybe it's already there, called Zara. The mall says the addition of Zara to their roster of stores solidifies their status as the ultimate destination for fashion-forward individuals. And evidently, Ben, you go there too, so what's the big deal?
I'm embarrassed to admit, yes.
What's the big deal? Quickly.
Luxury fast fashion at H&M prices, Mike.
Okay.
Yeah, and fashion and prices I've aged out of, unfortunately, I think.
Well, I don't know about the prices. You guys are news anchors. You must make a ton. Ben Thompson from WCNC-TV, Joe Bruner from WSOC-TV, Mary Ramsey from the Charlotte Observer, and Steve Harrison from us.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.